Body aboard, finished this morning. Only one shows antibodies, and he isn't really symptomatic. Risk factors? Gingivitis, bleeding gums, General Pickett reported. It's trying to be an aerosol, but that's what I think, Alex. The secondary cases appear to be mostly intimate contact, hugs, kisses, taking personal care of a loved one. If we're right, this will peak in 3 days, and then it'll stop. Along the way, we'll start seeing survivors. We have one of those at Hopkins. She's got the antibodies, but it didn't get beyond the initial presentation. We need to get Gus working on environmental degradation. He should be already. Agreed. You call him. I'm doing some follow-ups down here. The judge was an old friend of Keelty. Martin wasn't exactly sure how he'd fiddled with the docket in this particular district, but that didn't matter now. The two presentations had taken about 30 minutes each. It was, as Keelty had said, and the Solicitor General had agreed, a fundamentally simple point of law, though the practical applications of it led into all manner of complexity. It was also a matter of great urgency, as a result of which the judge reappeared from chambers after a mere hour's contemplation. He would read his decision from his notes and type up a full opinion later in the day. "The court," he began, "is cognizant of the grave danger facing the country, and must sympathize with President Ryan's sincerely felt duty to safeguard the lives of Americans in addition to their freedoms. However, the court must acknowledge the fact that the Constitution is, and remains, the supreme law of the land. To violate that legal bulwark is a step that potentially sets a precedent with consequences so grave as to reach beyond the current crisis. And though the President is certainly acting under the best motives, this court must vacate the executive order, trusting our citizens to act intelligently and prudently in the pursuit of their own safety. So ordered." "Your Honor," the Solicitor General stood, "the government will and must appeal your ruling immediately to the Fourth Circuit in Richmond. We request a stay until the paperwork can be processed later today." "Request is denied. Court is adjourned." The judge stood and left the bench without a further word. The room, of course, erupted. "What does this mean?" the court TV correspondent, himself a lawyer who knew what it probably meant, said to Ed Keelty, his microphone extended, as reporters tended to do at the moment. "It means that so-called President Ryan cannot break the law. I think I have shown here that the rule of law still exists in our country," the politician replied. He was not being overtly smug. "What does the government say?" the reporter asked the Solicitor General. "Not very much. We will have papers filed with the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals before Judge Venable has his opinion drafted. The order of the court is not officially binding until it is written up, signed, and properly filed. We'll have our appeal drafted first. The Fourth Circuit will stay the order."
"And if it doesn't?"
Martin took that on.
"In that case, sir, the executive order will remain in place in the interest of public safety until the case can be argued in a more structured setting. But there is every reason to believe that the Fourth Circuit will stay the order. Judges are people of reality in addition to being people of the written word. There is one other thing, however."
"Yes?" the reporter asked. Keelty was watching from 10 feet away. "The court has settled another important constitutional issue here. In referring to President Ryan by both his name and the title of his office, the court has settled the succession question raised by former Vice President Keelty. Further, the court said that that order was vacated. Had Mr. Ryan not been the president, the order would have been invalid and never legally binding, and the court could have stated that as well. Instead, the court acted improperly on point, I believe, but properly in a procedural sense. Thank you. The Solicitor General and I have to get some paperwork done." It wasn't often you shut reporters up. Shutting political figures up was harder still. "Now wait a minute," Keelty shouted.
You never were a very good lawyer, Ed, Martin said on his way past.
I think he's right, Lauren said. Jesus, I sure hope he is.
CDC laboratories had been frantically at work since the beginning, studying how the virus survived in the open. Environmental chambers were set up with differing values of temperature and humidity, and different light intensity levels, and the data, incomprehensibly, kept telling them the same thing. The disease that had to be spreading by aerosol wasn't, or at most it was barely doing so. Its survival in the open, even under benign conditions, was measured in minutes.
I wish I understood the warfare side of this a little better, Lawrence went on after a moment's thought.
2, 2, 3 primary cases, that's all. If there were more, we'd know by now. 18 confirmed sites, 4 additional trade shows that generated no hits. Why 18 and not the other 4? Alex wondered. What if they did hit all 22, but 4 didn't work?
On the basis of our experimental data, that's a real possibility, Alex.
Lawrence was pulling on his pipe. Our models now predict a total of 8,000 cases. We're going to get survivors, and the numbers on that will alter the model somewhat. This quarantine stuff has scared the shit out of people. You know, I don't think the travel ban really matters directly, but it scared people enough that they're not interacting enough to...
Doctor, that's the 3rd good piece of news today, Alexander breathed.
The first had been the woman at Hopkins. The second was Pickett's analytical data. Now the 3rd was Gus's lab work and the logical conclusion it led to.
John always said that bio-war was more psychological than real.
John's a smart doc, Alex. So are you, my friend.
3 days and we'll know.
Agreed.
Rattle some beads, Alex.
You can reach me through Reed for the time being.
I'm sleeping in the office, too.
See ya.
Alexander punched off the speakerphone. Around him were 6 Army physicians, 3 from Walter Reed, 3 from USAMRID.
Comments? He asked them.
Crazy situation, a major observed with an exhausted smile. It's a psychological weapon, all right. Scares the hell out of everybody. But that works for us, too. And somebody goofed on the other side. I wonder how...
Alex thought about that for a moment. Then he lifted the phone and dialed Johns Hopkins.
This is Dr. Alexander, he told the desk nurse on the medical floor. I need to talk to Dr. Ryan. It's very important.
Okay, I'll hold.
It took a few minutes.
Kathy?
Alex here. I need to talk to your husband, and it's better if you're there, too.
It's damned important, he told her a moment later.
Chapter 55. Commencement. 200 files meant 200 birth certificates, 200 driver's licenses, houses or apartments, sets of credit cards, and all manner of other permutations to be checked out. It was inevitable that once such an investigation started, Special Agent Arif Rehman would garner special attention from the 300 FBI agents assigned to the case. But, in fact, every Secret Service employee who had regular access to the White House was on the immediate checklist. All across the country, the USSS draws personnel from as wide a field as any other government agency, agents did start with birth certificates and move on, also checking high school yearbooks for graduation pictures to be compared with ID photos of all the agents. 3 agents on the detail turned out to be immigrants, some of whose exact personal details could not be easily checked. 1 was French-born, having come to America in his mother's arms. 1 hailed from Mexico, having actually come illegally with her parents. She'd later legitimatized her status and distinguished herself as a genius with the Technical Security Division and a ferociously patriotic member of the team. That left Jeff Rehman as an agent with some missing documentation, which was reasonably explained by his parents' reported refugee status. In many ways, it was too easy. It was on his record that he'd been born in Iran and had come to America when his parents had fled the country with the fall of the Shah's regime.
Every indicator since showed that he had fully adapted to his new country, even adopting a fanaticism for basketball that was a minor legend in the service. He almost never lost a wager on a game, and it was a standing joke that professional gamblers consulted him on the line for an important game. He was always one to enjoy a beer with his colleagues. He developed an outstanding service reputation as a field agent. He was unmarried. That was not terribly unusual for a federal law enforcement officer. The Secret Service was especially tough on spouses who had to share their loved ones, mainly husbands, with a job far more unforgiving than the most demanding mistress, which made divorce more common than marriage. He'd been seen around with female company, but didn't talk about that much. Insofar as he had a private life, it was a quiet one. It was certain that he'd had no contacts at all with other Iranian-born citizens or aliens, that he was not the least bit religious, that he'd never once brought up Islam in a conversation, except to say, as he'd told the president once, that religion had caused his family so much grief that it was a subject he was just as happy to leave alone. Inspector O'Day, back at work because Director Murray trusted him with the sensitive cases, was not the least bit impressed with this or any other story. He supervised the investigation. He assumed that the adversary, if he existed, would be an expert, and therefore the most plausible and consistent identity was to him only a potential cover to be examined. Better yet, there were no rules on this one. Agent Price had made that determination herself. He picked the local investigating team himself from Headquarters Division and the Washington Field Office. The best of them he assigned to Arif Rehman, now conveniently in Pittsburgh. His apartment in Northwest D.C. was modest but comfortable. It had a burglar alarm, but that was not a problem. The agents selected for the illegal breaking and entering included a technical wizard who, after defeating the locks in 2 minutes, recognized the control panel and punched in the maker's emergency code. He had them all memorized, to deactivate the system. This procedure had once been called a black bag job, a term which had fallen by the wayside, though the function itself had not quite done so. Now the term special operation was used, which could mean anything one wanted it to. The first two agents in the door called three more into the apartment after the break-in had been effected. They photographed the apartment first of all, looking for possible telltales, seemingly innocent or random objects which, if disturbed in any way, warned the occupant that someone had been inside. These could be devilishly hard things to detect and defeat. But all five of the agents were part of the FBI's Foreign Counterintelligence Division, both trained against and trained by professional spooks. Shaking the apartment would take hours of exquisitely tedious effort. They knew that at least five other teams were doing the same thing to other potential subjects. The P-3C was hovering at the edge of the radar coverage for the Indian ships, keeping low and bumping through the Royal Air over the warm surface of the Arabian Sea. They had tracks on 30 emitters from 19 sources. The powerful low-frequency search radars were the ones they worried about most, though the threat receivers were getting traces of SAM radars as well. Supposedly, the Indians were running exercises, their fleet back at sea after a long stand-down for maintenance. The problem was that such workup exercises were quite indistinguishable from battle readiness. The data being analyzed by the onboard ELINT crew was downlinked to ANZIO and the rest of the escorts for task group comedy, as the sailors had taken to calling the four Bob Hopes and their escorts. The group commander was sitting in his cruiser's combat information center. The three large billboard displays, actually rear projection televisions linked to the Aegis radar computer system, showed the location of the Indian battle group with a fair degree of precision. He even knew which of the blips were probably the carriers. His task was a complex one. Comedy was now fully formed. Underway replenishment ships Platt and Supply were now attached to the group, along with their escorts Hawes and Carr.
and over the next few hours all of the escorts would take turns alongside to top off their fuel bunkers. For a Navy captain, having too much fuel was like having too much money. Impossible. After that, the UNREP ships would be ordered to take position outboard of the leading tank carriers, and the frigates outboard of the trailers. O'Bannon would move forward to continue her ASW search. The Indians had two nuclear submarines, and nobody seemed to know where they were at the moment. Kidd and Anzio, both SAM ships, would back into the formation, providing close air defense. Ordinarily, the Aegis cruiser would stand farther out, but not now. The reason for that came not from his mission orders, but from TV. Every naval vessel in the group had its own satellite TV receiver. In the modern Navy, the sailors wanted and got their own cable system. And while the crew spent most of their time watching the various movie channels, Playboy was always a favorite, sailors being sailors, the group commander was overdosing on CNN. Because, while his mission orders didn't always give him all the background information he needed for his mission, very often commercial TV did. The crews were tense. The news of events at home could not have been concealed from them in any case, and the images of sick and dying people, blocked interstates and empty city streets, had initially shaken them badly, causing officers and chiefs to sit down with the men on the mess decks to talk things through. Then had come these orders. Things were happening in the Persian Gulf. Things were happening at home. And all of a sudden the MPS ships, with their brigade set of combat vehicles, were heading for the Saudi port of Dharan, and the Indian Navy was in the way. The crew was quiet now, Captain Greg Kemper of USS Anzio saw. His chiefs reported that the troops were not laughing and cutting up in the mess rooms, and the constant simulations on the Aegis combat system in the past few days had conveyed their own message. Comedy was sailing in harm's way. Each of the escorting ships had a helicopter. These coordinated with the crack ASW team on O'Bannon, namesake of the Navy's Golden Ship of World War II, a Fletcher-class destroyer which had fought in every major Pacific engagement without a casualty or a scratch. The new one had a gold A on her superstructure, the mark of a submarine killer of note, at least in simulation. Kidd's heritage was less lucky. Named for Admiral Isaac Kidd, who had died aboard USS Arizona on the morning of December 7, 1941, she was a member of the Dead Admiral class of four missile destroyers originally built for the Iranian Navy under the Shah, forced on a reluctant President Carter, and then perversely all named for admirals who died in losing battles. Anzio, in one of the Navy's stranger traditions, was named for a land battle, part of the Italian campaign in 1943, in which a daring invasion had developed into a desperate struggle. Ships of war were actually made for that sort of business, but it was the business of their commanders to see that the desperate part applied to the other guy. In a real war, that would have been easy. Anzio had 15 Tomahawk missiles aboard, each with a 1,000-pound warhead, and nearly in range of the Indian battle group. In an ideal world, he'd loose them at just over 200 miles, based on targeting information from the Orions. His helicopters could do that too, but the P-3Cs were far more survivable. "Captain," it was a petty officer on the ESM board, "we're getting airborne radars. The Orion has some company approaching. Looks like two Harriers. Distance unknown, constant bearing, signal strength increasing." "Thank you. It's a free sky until somebody says different," Kemper reminded everybody. Maybe it was an exercise, but the Indian battle group hadn't moved 40 miles in the past day. Instead, traveling back and forth, east and west, crossing and recrossing its own course track. Exercises were supposed to be more free-form than that. What the situation told the captain of USS Anzio was that they'd staked out this piece of ocean as their own. And the Indians just happened to be between where comedy was and where it wanted to be. Nothing was very secret about it either. Everyone pretended that normal peacetime conditions were in effect. Anzio had her Spy 1 radar operating, pumping out millions of watts. The Indians were using theirs as well. It was almost like a game of chicken. "Captain, we have bogeys. We have unknown multiple air contacts bearing 070, range 215 miles. No squawk ident. They are not commercial. Designate Raid 1. The symbols came up on the center screen. "No emitters on that bearing," ESM reported. "Very well." The captain crossed his legs in his command chair. In the movies, this was where Gary Cooper lit up a smoke. "Raid 1 appears to be four aircraft in formation, speed 450 knots, course 245, which made them inbounds, though not quite directly at Comedy. "Projected CPA?" the captain asked. "They will pass within 20 miles on their current course, sir," a sailor responded crisply. "Very well. Okay, people, listen up. I want this place cool and businesslike. You all know the job. When there's reason to be excited, I will be the one to tell you," he told the CIC crew. "Weapons tight." Meaning that peacetime rules still applied, and nothing was actually ready to fire. A situation that could be remedied by turning a few keys. "Anzio, this is Gonzo 4, over," a voice called on the air-to-surface radio. "Gonzo 4, Anzio, over." "Anzio," the aviator reported. "We got two Harriers playing tag with us. One just zipped by at about 50 yards. He's got white ones on the rails. Real missiles hanging under the wings, not pretend ones." "Doing anything?" the air control officer asked. "Negative, just like he's playing a little." "Tell him to continue the mission," the captain said, "and pretend he doesn't care." "Aye, sir." The message was relayed. This sort of thing wasn't all that unusual. Fighter pilots were fighter pilots, the captain knew. They never grew up past the stage of buzzing by girls on their bikes. He directed his attention to Raid 1. Course and speed were unchanged. This wasn't a hostile act. The Indians were letting him know that they knew who was in their neighborhood. That was evident from the appearance of fighters in two places at the same time. It was definitely a game of chicken now. What to do now, he wondered. Play tough? Play dumb? Play apathetic? People so often overlooked the psychological aspect of military operations. Raid 1 was now 150 miles out, rapidly approaching the range of his SM-2 MR SAMs. "What do you think, Weps?" he asked his weapons officer. "I think they're just trying to piss us off." "Agreed." The captain flipped a mental coin. "Well, they're harassing the Orion. Let 'em know we see 'em," he ordered. 2 seconds later, the spy search radar jacked up its power to 4 million watts. Sent all of it down 1 degree of bearing at the inbound fighters, and increased the dwell on the targets, which meant they were being hit almost continuously. It was enough to peg the threat detection gear they had to have aboard. Inside of 20 miles, it could even start damaging such equipment, depending on how delicate it was. That was called a Zorch, and the captain still had another 2 million watts of power up his sleeve. The joke was that if you really pissed off an Aegis, you might start producing two-headed kids. "Kid just went to battle station, sir," the officer of the deck reported. "Good training time, isn't it? Range to Raid 1 was just over 100 miles now. Weps, light him up." With that command, the ship's four SPG-51 target illumination radars turned, sending pencil beams of X-band energy at the inbound fighters. These radars told the missiles how to find their targets. The Indian threat gear would pick that up, too. The fighters didn't change course or speed. "Okay, that means we're not playing rough today. If they were of a mind to do something, they'd be maneuvering now," the captain told his crew. "You know, like turning the corner when you see a cop." Or they had ice water in their veins, which didn't seem likely. "Going to eyeball the formation?" Weps asked. "That's what I'd do. Take some pictures. See what's here," Kemper thought. "A lot of things happening at once, sir."
Yep, the captain agreed, watching the display. He lifted the growler phone.
Bridge, the OOD answered.
Tell your lookouts I want to know what they are. Photos, if possible.
How's visibility topside?
Surface haze. Not bad aloft, sir. I've got men on the big eyes now.
Very well.
They'll go past us to the north, turn left, and come down our port side, the captain predicted.
Sir, Gonzo 4 reports a very close pass a few seconds ago, air control said.
Tell him to stay cool.
Aye, Cap'n.
The situation developed quickly after that. The fighters circled Comedy twice, never closer than 5 nautical miles. The Indian Harriers spent another 15 minutes around the patrolling Orion, then had to return back to their carrier to refuel. And another day at sea continued with no shots fired and no overtly hostile acts, unless you counted the fighter play, and that was pretty routine. When all was settled down, the captain of USS Anzio turned to his communications officer.
I need to talk to Sinklant.
Oh, Weps, Kemper added.
Yes, sir.
I want every combat system on this ship fully checked out.
Sir, we just ran a full check 12 hours.
Right now, Weps, he emphasized quietly.
And that's good news? Kathy asked.
Doctor, that's real simple, Alexander said in reply. You watched some people die this morning. You will watch more die tomorrow, and that stinks. But thousands is better than millions, isn't it? I think this epidemic is going to burn out. He didn't add that it was somewhat easier for him. Kathy was an eye-cutter. She wasn't used to dealing with death. He was infectious diseases, and he was used to it.
Easier? Was that the word?
We'll know in a couple of days from statistical analysis of the cases.
The president nodded silently. Van Damme spoke for him.
What's the count going to be?
Less than 10,000, according to the computer models at Reed and Dietrich. Sir, I am not being cavalier about this. I'm saying that 10,000 is better than 10 million.
One death is a tragedy, and a million is a statistic, Ryan said finally.
Yes, sir, I know that one.
The good news didn't make Alexander all that happy. But how else to tell people that a disaster was better than a catastrophe?
Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin, swordsman told them. He did have a way with words.
You know who did it, Alex observed.
What makes you say that? Jack asked.
You didn't react normally to what I told you, Mr. President.
Doctor, I haven't done much of anything normally over the past few months. What does this mean about the no-travel order?
It means we leave it in place for at least another week. Our prediction is not carved in stone. The incubation period for the disease is somewhat variable. You don't send the fire trucks home as soon as the last flame disappears. You sit there and watch for another possible flare-up. That will happen here, too. What's worked to this point is that people are frightened to death. Because of that, personal interactions are minimized, and that's how you stop one of these things. We keep 'em that way. The new cases will be very circumscribed. We attack those like we did with smallpox. Identify the cases, test everyone with whom they've had contact, isolate the ones with antibodies, and see how they do. It's working, okay? Whoever did this miscalculated. The disease isn't anywhere near as contagious as they thought. Or maybe the whole thing was just a psychological exercise. That's what bio-war is. The great plagues of the past really happened because people didn't know how diseases spread. They didn't know about microbes and fleas and contaminated water. We do. Everybody does. You learn it in health class in school. Hell, that's why we haven't had any medics infected. We've had lots of practice dealing with AIDS and hepatitis. The same precautions that work with those also work with this.
How do we keep it from happening again? Van Damme asked.
I told you that already. Funding. Basic research on the genetic side and more focused work on the diseases we know about. There's no particular reason why we can't develop safe vaccines for Ebola and a lot of others.
AIDS? Ryan asked.
Well, that's a toughie. That virus is an agile little bastard. No attempt for a vaccine has even come close yet. No, on that side, basic genetic research to determine how the biologic mechanism works.
and from that to get the immune system to recognize it and kill it. Some sort of vaccine. That's what a vaccine is. But how to make it work, well, we haven't figured that one yet. We'd better. In 20 years we might have to write Africa off. Hey, the Creole said, I got kin over there, you know. That's one way to keep it from happening again. You, Mr. President, are already working on the other way. Who was it? He didn't have to tell anybody how secret it was. Iran. The Ayatollah Mahmoud Haji Dariai and his merry men. Alexander reverted to officer in the United States Army. Sir, you can kill all of them you want, as far as I'm concerned. It was interesting to see Mehrabad International Airport in daylight. Clark had never experienced Iran as a friendly country. Supposedly, before the fall of the Shah, the people had been friendly enough, but he hadn't made the trip soon enough for that. He'd come in covertly in 1979 and again in 1980, first to develop information for, and then to participate in, the attempt to rescue the hostages. There were no words to describe what it was like to be in a country in a revolutionary condition. His time on the ground in the Soviet Union had been far more comfortable. Enemy or not, Russia had always been a civilized country with lots of rules and citizens who broke them. But Iran had ignited like a dry forest in a lightning storm. Death to America had been a chant on everyone's lips, and that, he remembered, was about as scary as things got when you were in the middle of the mob singing that song. One little mistake, just contacting an agent who'd been turned, would have been his death. Rather a frightening thought to a man with young children, spook or no spook. Locally, they shot some criminals, but spies they mostly hanged. It seemed a gratuitously cruel way to take a man's life. Some things had changed in the intervening years. Some had not. There was still a suspicion of foreigners here at the customs post. The clerk was backed up by armed men, and their job was to prevent the entry of people like him. For the new UIR, as for the previous country, every new face was a potential spy. Clerk, he said, handing over his passport. Ivan Sergeyevich. What the hell, the Russian cover identity had worked before, and he already had it memorized. Better yet, his Russian was letter perfect. He'd passed as a Soviet citizen before a uniformed official more than once. Chekhov, Yevgeny Pavlovich, Chavez told the next clerk over. They were, again, news correspondents. Rules prohibited CIA officers from covering themselves as American reporters, but that didn't apply to the foreign media.
The purpose of your visit? The first clerk asked.
To learn about your new country, Ivan Sergeyevich replied. It must be very exciting for everyone. For their work in Japan, they'd brought camera gear and a useful little gadget that looked like, and indeed was, a bright light. Not this time.
He and I are together, Yevgeny Pavlovich told his clerk.
The passports were brand new, though one could not have told it from casual inspection. It was one of the few things Clark and Chavez didn't have to worry about. RVS Tradecraft was every bit as good as the former KGB's had been. They made some of the best fake documents in the world. The pages were covered with stamps, many overlapping, and were creased and dog-eared from years of apparent use. An inspector grabbed their bags and opened them. He found clothing, clearly much used, two books, which he flipped through to see if they were pornographic, two cameras of medium quality, their black enamel well-chipped, but the lenses new. Each had a carry-on bag with notepads and many tape recorders. The inspectors took their time, even after the clerks had done their work, finally passing their country's visitors through with a palpable reluctance.
Spasibo, John said pleasantly, getting his bags and moving off.
Over the years, he'd learned not to conceal his relief completely. Normal travelers were intimidated. He had to be, too, lest he stand apart from them. The two CIA officers went outside to catch a cab, standing together in line silently as the rank of taxis ate up the new arrivals.
When they were two back, Chavez dropped his travel bag, and the contents spilled out. He and Clark let two people jump ahead of them in line while he repacked the bag. That almost certainly guaranteed a random cab, unless they were all being driven by spooks. The trick was to look normal in all respects. Not too stupid, never too smart. To get disoriented and ask for directions, but not too often. To stay in cheap hotels. And in their particular case, to pray that none of the people who'd seen them during their brief visit to this city crossed their path. The mission was supposed to be a simple one. That was usually the idea. You rarely sent intelligence officers out on complex missions. They'd have the good sense to refuse. The simple ones were hairy enough once you got out there. "It's called Task Group Comedy," Robbie told him. They got their doorbell rung this morning. The J-3 explained on for a few minutes. "Playing rough?" the president asked. "Evidently, they gave the P-3 a real air show. I've done that myself a few times back in my young and foolish days. They want us to know they're there, and they're not intimidated. The group commander is Greg Kemper. I don't know him, but his rep's pretty good. Sinklamp likes him. He's asking for a row change." "Not yet. Later today." "Okay. I would not expect a night attack, but remember, dawn there is midnight here, sir." "Arnie, what's the book on the PM?" "She and Ambassador Williams don't exchange Christmas presents," the chief of staff replied. "You met her in the East Room a while back." "Warning her off risks having her call Daria," Ben Goodley reminded them all. "If you confront her, she'll weasel on you." "And? Robbie?" "If we get past the Indians, but she warns Darii?" "They can try to block the strait. The Med Force will turn the corner in a few hours and join up 50 miles off the entrance. We'll have air cover. It could be exciting, but they should make it. Mines are the scary part. The strait there is pretty deep for them. Closer into Dauran is another story. The longer the UIR is in the dark, the better. But they may already know what comedy is made up of." Or maybe not, Van Dam thought. If she thinks she can handle it herself, she might just try to show him what kind of ball she has. The transfer was called Operation Custer. All 40 aircraft were aloft now, each carrying roughly 250 soldiers in a skytrain 6,000 miles long. The lead aircraft were now 6 hours out from Dauran, leaving Russian airspace and overflying Ukraine. The F-15 pilots had traded waves with a handful of Russian fighters which had come up to say hello. They were tired now. Their rumps were like painful lead from all the time in the same seat. The airliner pilots behind them could get up and move around. They even had toilets, quite a luxury for a fighter pilot who had an appliance called a relief tube. Arms tightened up. Muscles were sore from staying in the same position. It was to the point that tanking from their KC-135s was becoming difficult, and gradually they came to the opinion that an air-to-air engagement an hour out from their destination might not be much fun at all. Most drank coffee, tried to shift hands on the stick, and stretched as much as they could. The soldiers were mainly sleeping, still ignorant of the nature of their mission. The airlines had stocked their aircraft normally, and the troops indulged what would be their last chance to have a drink for some time to come. Those who had deployed to Saudi in 1990 and 1991 told their war stories, chief among which was the memory that the kingdom wasn't a place you went to for the nightlife. Neither was Indiana, Brown and Holbrook had found, at least not now. They had at least been smart enough to get into a motel before the general panic, and here they were trapped. This motel, like the ones they'd used in Wyoming and Nebraska, catered to truckers. It had a large restaurant, the old-fashioned sort with a counter and booths, and now with masked waitresses and customers who didn't group closely together to socialize. Instead, they ate their meals and went back to their rooms, or to sleep in their trucks.
There was a daily dance of sorts. The trucks had to be moved, lest staying in the exact same spot damage the tires. Everyone listened to the radio for hourly news broadcasts. The rooms, the restaurant, and even some of the trucks had televisions for further information and distraction. There was boredom, the tent sort, familiar to soldiers but not known to the two mountain men. "Goddamn government," a furniture hauler said. He had family 2 states away. "I guess they showed us who was boss, eh?" Ernie Brown said, for general consumption. Later, data would show that not a single interstate trucker had caught the virus. Their existence was too solitary for that. But their working lives depended on movement, both because they earned their living that way and because they had chosen to do so. Sitting still was not in their nature. Being told to sit still was even less so. "What the hell?" another driver added. He couldn't think of anything else to say. "Goddamn glad I got out of Chicago when I did. That news is scary." "You suppose this all makes sense?" someone asked. "Since when does the government make sense?" Holbrook griped. "I hear that," a voice chimed in. And finally the mountain men felt at home somewhere. Then, by unspoken consent, it was time for them to leave. "How the hell much longer will we be stuck here, Pete?" Ernie Brown wanted to know. "You're asking me?" "A whole lot of nothing," concluded the lead agent. Arif Rehman was a little neat for a single man living alone, but not grossly so. One of the FBI agents had noted with surprise that even the man's socks were neatly folded, along with everything else in the bureau drawers. Then one of the group remembered a study of NFL football players. A psychologist had determined, after months of study, that offensive linemen, whose job was to protect the quarterback, had neat lockers, while defensive linemen, whose job it was to pound the opposing quarterbacks into the turf, were slobs in every respect. It was good for a laugh and an explanation. Nothing else was found. There was a photo of his parents, both dead. He subscribed to 2 news magazines, had the full cable options for his 2 televisions, had no booze in the house, and ate healthy. He had a particular affinity for kosher hot dogs, judging by the freezer. There were no hidden drawers or compartments. They would have found them. And nothing the least bit suspicious. That was both good news and bad. The phone rang. Nobody answered it, because they weren't there, and they had beepers and cellular phones for their own communications needs. "Hello, this is 536-3040, the recording of Raymond's voice said, after the second ring. "Nobody's here to answer the phone right now, but if you leave a message, somebody will get back to you." Followed by a beep, and in this case, a click. "Wrong number," one of the agents said. "Pull the messages," the lead agent ordered the technical genius on the team. Rehman owned a digital recording system, and again there was a punch code programmed in by the manufacturer. The agent hit the 6 digits and another took notes. There were 3 clicks and a wrong number. Somebody calling for Mr. Sloan, whoever that was. "Rug? Mr. Rallahad?" "Sounds like the name of a rug dealer," another one said. But when they looked around, there was no such rug in the apartment, just the usual cheap wall-to-wall carpet you found in apartments of this type. "Wrong number." "Run the names anyway." It was more habit than anything else. You checked everything. It was like working FCI. You just never knew. Just then the phone rang again, and all 5 of the agents turned to stare at the answering machine, as though it were a real witness with a real voice. Shit, Rehman thought. He'd forgotten to erase the messages from before. There was nothing new. His control officer hadn't called again. It would have been a surprise if he had. With that determined, Rehman, sitting in a Pittsburgh hotel room, punched the erase-all code. One nice thing about the new digitals was that, once erased, they were gone forever. That wasn't necessarily true of the ones using tape cassettes.
The FBI agents took note of that, sharing looks.
Hey, we all do that.
There was general agreement.
And everybody got wrong numbers, too.
And this was a brother officer.
But they'd run the numbers anyway.
Surgeon, to the relief of her detail, was sleeping upstairs in the residence. Roy Altman and the rest assigned to guard her had been going crazy with her on the fever ward, their term for it, at Johns Hopkins, as much from the physical danger as for the fact that she had run herself right into the ground. The kids, being kids, had spent the time like most other American children, watching TV and playing under the eyes of their agents, who now worried about seeing the onset of flu symptoms, blessedly absent from the entire campus. Swordsman was in the Situation Room.
"What's the time there?"
10 hours ahead, sir.
"Make the call," POTUS ordered.
The first 747 in United livery crossed into Saudi airspace a few minutes earlier than expected, due to favorable Arctic winds. A more circuitous routing at this point would not have helped very much. Sudan had airports and radars too, as did Egypt and Jordan, and it was assumed that the UIR had informants somewhere in those countries. The Saudi Air Force, augmented by the F-16Cs which had sneaked in from Israel the previous day as part of Buffalo Forward, stood combat air patrol along the Saudi UIR border. 2 E-3B AWACS were up and turning their rotodomes. The sun was rising now in that part of the world. At least one could see first light from their cruising altitude, though the surface, 6 miles below, was still black.
"Good morning, Prime Minister. This is Jack Ryan," the President said.
"A pleasure to hear your voice. It is late in Washington, is it not?" she asked.
"We both work irregular hours. I imagine your day is just beginning."
"So it is," the voice answered.
Ryan had a conventional receiver to his ear. The conversation was on speakerphone as well, and feeding into a digital tape recorder. The CIA had even supplied a voice stress analyzer.
"Mr. President, the troubles in your country, have they improved?"
"We have some hope, but no, not quite yet."
"Is there any way in which we might be of assistance?"
Neither voice showed the least emotion beyond the false amity of people suspicious of each other and trying to hide it.
"Well, yes, actually there is."
"Please, then, how may we be of help?"
"Prime Minister, we have some ships heading through the Arabian Sea at the moment," Ryan told her.
"Is that so?"
Total neutrality in the voice.
"Yes, ma'am, it is. And you know it is. And I want your personal assurance that your Navy, which is also at sea, will not interfere with their passage."
"But why do you ask this?
Why should we interfere?
For that matter, what is the purpose of your ship movement?"
"Your word on the matter will suffice, Prime Minister," Ryan told her. His right hand gripped a No. 2 lead pencil.
"But, Mr. President, I fail to understand the purpose of this call."
"The purpose of this call is to seek your personal assurance that the Indian Navy will not interfere with the peaceful passage of United States Navy ships through the Arabian Sea." He was so weak, she thought, repeating himself that way.
"Mr. President, I find your call unsettling. America has never spoken to us about such a matter before. You say you move warships close to my country, but not the purpose for the move. The movement of such vessels without an explanation is not the act of a friend."
What if she could make him back down? "What did I tell you?" the note from Ben Goodley read. "Very well, Prime Minister. For the third time, will you give me your assurance that there will be no interference in this activity?"
"But why are you invading our waters?" she asked again.
"Very well."
Ryan paused, and then his voice changed.
"Prime Minister, the purpose of the movement does not directly concern your country. but I assure you, those ships will sail on to their destination. Since their mission is one of importance to us, we will not, I repeat, not, brook interference of any kind. And I must warn you that should any unidentified ship or aircraft approach our formation, there might be adverse consequences. No, please excuse me, there will be such consequences. To avoid that, I give you notice of the passage, and I request your personal assurance to the United States of America that there will be no attack on our ships.
And now you threaten me? Mr. President, I understand the stress which has come to you of late, but please, you may not treat sovereign countries in this way.
Prime Minister, then I will speak very clearly. An overt act of war has been committed against the United States of America. Any interference with or attack on any part of our military will be deemed a further act of war, and whatever country commits such an act will face the most serious possible consequences.
But who has done this to you?
Prime Minister, that is not your concern, unless you wish it to be. I think in the interests of both your country and mine, it would be well if your navy returned to port forthwith.
And you blame us? You order us?
I began with a request, Prime Minister. You saw fit to evade my request 3 times. I regard that as an unfriendly act. And so I have a new question. Is it your desire to be at war with the United States of America?
Mr. President,
because if those ships don't move, Prime Minister, you will be. The pencil snapped in Ryan's hand. I think you may have associated yourself with the wrong friends, Prime Minister. I hope I am incorrect. But if my impression is correct, then your country could well pay dearly for that misjudgment. We have experienced a direct attack on our citizens. It is a particularly cruel and barbaric attack, utilizing weapons of mass destruction. He enunciated these words very clearly. This is not yet known to our citizens. That will soon change, he told her. When it does, Prime Minister, those guilty of launching that attack will face our justice. We will not send notes of protest. We will not call a special meeting of the UN Security Council in New York. We will make war, Prime Minister. We will make war with all the power and rage this country and her citizens can muster. Do you now understand what I am saying? Ordinary men, women, and now even children have been murdered within our borders by a foreign power. There has even been an attack upon my own child, Prime Minister. Does your country wish to be associated with those acts? If so, Prime Minister, if you wish to be part of that, then the war commences now.
Chapter 56 Deployment.
Jesus, Jack, you had me convinced, Jackson breathed.
Our friend in the clergy won't be as easy, the President said. He rubbed his 2 sweaty hands together. And we still don't know if she'll keep her word. Okay, task group comedy is at DEFCON 1. If they think it's hostile, kill it. But for Christ's sake, make sure that commander knows how to use his head. The Situation Room was quiet now, and President Ryan felt very alone, despite the people assembled around him. Secretary Brattano and the Joint Chiefs were there. Rutledge was there for state. Secretary Winston, because Ryan trusted his judgment. Goodley, because he was fully briefed in on all the intelligence information, plus his chief of staff and the usual bodyguards. They all showed their support, but it really didn't help all that much. He alone had talked to India, because despite all the help and staff and advice, Jack Ryan was now the United States of America, and the country was going to war. The media pool learned that over the Atlantic Ocean. America expected an attack at any time from the United Islamic Republic into the other Gulf states. They would be there to cover the story. They also learned about the forces being deployed.
That's all? One of the more knowledgeable of them asked.
That's it for the moment, the public affairs officer confirmed. We hope that the show of force will be sufficient to deter the attack. But if not,
It's going to be exciting.
Exciting ain't the word.
Then the PAO told them why it was happening, and the windowless KC-135 that was taking them to Saudi Arabia became very quiet indeed. Kuwait essentially had two heavy brigades, complemented by a motorized reconnaissance brigade equipped with anti-tank weapons and designed to be a screening force on the border. The two heavy brigades, equipped and trained on the American model, were held back from the border in the usual way so as to be able to move to counter an incursion rather than having to meet the initial attack, possibly in the wrong place. The 10th U.S. Cavalry stood between and slightly behind those two. Overall command was somewhat equivocal. Colonel Magruder was the most senior officer in time of service, and the most experienced tactician, but there were Kuwaitis more senior in rank. All three brigades were commanded by brigadier generals, and it was their country. On the other hand, the country was small enough to require only one primary command post, and Magruder was there, both to command his regiment and to advise the Kuwaiti commanders. The latter were both proud and nervous. They were understandably pleased by the strides their small country had made since 1990. No longer the comic opera force which had disintegrated on the Iraqi invasion, though some subunits had fought bravely. They had what looked on paper and to the eye like a very capable mechanized force. They were nervous because they were heavily outnumbered, and their mainly reservist soldiers had a long way to go before they met the American training standards to which they aspired. But the one thing they knew was gunnery. Shooting tanks is as enjoyable a pastime as it is a vital one. The empty slots in their formations were explained by the fact that 20 tanks were in the shop for replacement of their main gun tubes. That was being done by civilian contractors while the tank crews paced and waited. The 10th Cav's helicopters were flying around the country's border, their longbow radars looking deep into the UIR for movement, and so far seeing nothing of particular note. The Kuwaiti Air Force was standing a four-plane combat air patrol, with the rest of the force on high alert. Outmanned though they were, this would not be a repeat of 1990. The busiest people were the engineers, who were digging holes for all the tanks so that they could fight hull down, with only their turret showing. These were covered with netting to make them invisible from the air.
"And so, Colonel?" the senior Kuwaiti commander asked.
"Nothing wrong with your deployments, General," Magruder replied, scanning the map again. He didn't show everything he felt. 2 or 3 weeks of intensive training would have been a blessing. He'd run one very simple exercise, one of his squadrons against the Kuwaiti 1st Brigade, and even then he'd gone very easy on them. It wasn't the time to break their confidence. They had enthusiasm, and their gunnery was about 70% of American standards, but they had a lot to learn about maneuver warfare. Well, it took time to raise an army, and more time to train field officers, and they were doing their best.
"Your Highness, I need to thank you for your cooperation to this point," Ryan said over the phone. The wall clock in the sit room said 2:10.
"Jack, with luck, they will see this and not move," Prince Ali bin Sheikh replied.
"I wish I could agree with that. It is time for me to tell you something that you do not yet know, Ali. Our ambassador will present you with full information later in the day. For the moment, you need to know what your neighbors have been up to. It isn't just about the oil, Your Highness." He went on for 5 minutes.
"Are you certain of this?"
"The evidence we have will be in your hands in 4 hours," Ryan promised. "We haven't even told our soldiers yet."
"Might they use these weapons against us?"
The natural question. Biological warfare made everyone's skin crawl.
"We don't think so, Ali. Environmental conditions militate against it.
That had been checked, too. The weather forecast for the next week was hot, dry, and clear. "Those who would use such weapons, Mr. President, this is an act of utter barbarism.
That's why we do not expect them to back down."